of these places where powerful people convene. He talked about Shell's oil plants. He talked about that they had just secured access to drill for oil in the deep offshore Gulf of Mexico in the Appomattox field. So that's like, you know, a week before on the same exact news network, he's talking about how excited he is about its oil finds. He described it as a, quote, world-class oil and gas project. And then a week later, talking to Bloomberg, he's talking about how they may take oil out of its name. So they really, I mean, it shows even the lack of accountability in a network, a news network that just a week earlier was involved in an interview talking about Shell's oil plant. Didn't even question him on the same, you know, the interview they did the week before.
We're fresh out of time, as always. Steve, thank you again so very much for the conversation. These people are shameless. They take your breath away. Thank you so much for that. My guest, of course, has been Steve Horn with the Smog Blog. We also had the privilege of speaking once again with James Henry. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, July 13th, 2015. Kate Welsh engineered the show for us today. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Should it be harder for landlords to evict their tenants for no reason at all?
Should safe and healthy homes come before the interests of private investment?
Is the rent too damn high?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, join us for the next Portland Renters Assembly.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right.
The next two assemblies are on Sunday, July 12th, from 12 to 2 p.m. at the North Portland Library, with speakers on how race intersects with gentrification.
And on Wednesday, July 15th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Colonel Sumner's Park, with speakers on community organizing and mobilizing.
Tell your story and join the conversation. For more information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The prosperous economies and the culture of growth that industrialized nations take for normal and that most other nations aspire to rest on cheap energy. But now that we've tapped the easy energy stores, the push for continued growth is taking increasing amounts of energy and investment money, leaving less for every other activity. This morning, we talk with Nathan John Hagans, a former hedge fund manager, about the contradictions we face as the wealthy nations of the world and those aspiring to wealth try to balance the unsustainable equation of perpetual growth and limited natural and financial capital. Nate now teaches human ecology at the University of Minnesota. He contributed the article Energy, Credit, and the End of Growth to World Watch Institute's State of the World 2015 anthology. Nate, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. I want to start by asking you, what is human ecology?
It's short for explaining the human ecosystem, which is a interdisciplinary connection of anthropology, human behavior, environmental science, macroeconomics, and how it fits into explaining humans and our ecosystem.
And so that kind of all falls into the subject matter of your article about energy credit and the end of growth, about how our relationship to energy really is probably at the root of what the human ecosystem is all about.
Well, I mean, humans are a biological organisms, and so we have to look at, like we would if we were studying a cheetah or a lion or an elephant, we have to look at what we eat and where it comes from and the stocks and flows of our supplies, of our resources, and how we function as kind of a 7.3 billion and growing superorganism on the planet, and what that implies for our future and for the future of other species and ecosystems on this planet.
Well, your article starts by talking about the American dream. And basically, it looks at how that's really at odds with a lot of the realities that you start to pursue in the rest of the article. But I wanted to have you describe what your take on the American dream is, and why do you feel like it is a detriment to true sustainability?
Well, first of all, we have to talk about the power of fossil fuels. One barrel of oil has almost 6 million BTUs, which translated into work potential is 1,700 kilowatt hours of work. And I could do, or you could do, about 6/10 of a kilowatt hour in a day. So it would take you or I 10 or 11 years of physical work to generate the energy and work potential that's in one barrel of oil, and that costs us historically $20. So we found this country relatively empty, full of natural resources, and in the last 10 years, in the last 30 years, in the last 100 years, since the beginning of time, America, United States of America, has burned more fossil energy than any other country on Earth. So a large part of what has, yes, we're ambitious, yes, we're clever, yes, we have great technology, but a lot of that has been subsidized and explained by this huge natural resource, particularly energy bounty, that was in this country, and that's also allowed us to have the world's reserve currency and all the benefits that we get from that. So the American dream, we like to think, is just because we're somehow special, but it's largely explained by our access and burning of stored sunlight that's been sitting there untapped for hundreds of millions of years.
Well, you also talk about how, and on the one hand, the GDP and the stock market reflect that the American dream is rebounding again after the Great Recession, but there's other indicators that would point otherwise. So what are those indicators, and how do they reflect on what the GDP and the stock market are all about?
Well, let's talk about GDP and the stock market first. GDP is really a reflection of how much energy and throughput we're burning at one time, because we measure goods and services. We don't measure bads. We only measure goods. So oil spills and prison populations and obesity drugs and rape counseling and anything that we would consider bad also is a positive to GDP. And stock markets are really more reflections of supply and demand for securities than they are some voting mechanism for the future. We take a company's earnings this quarter or this year, and we multiply it by some number, extrapolating future earnings and bringing them back to today. But those future earnings are heavily dependent on cheap energy, and so I think they're probably a little off in their 10-year forecast. We've already, in the last 10 years, only the top 5% of income, highest income people in our nation, have higher income than they did a decade ago. 95% of Americans have the same or lower take-home pay after adjusting for inflation than a decade ago. So real wages for most people have peaked a long time ago. And so you see the stock market is a reflection of the productivity and profits, which are also, of course, influenced by some of the government and central bank guarantees and the things that they did to offset the great recession in 2008 and 9. But I think just looking around, I'm sure in your state is the same as where I live, that a lot of people are struggling. I mean, I think 50% plus or minus of Americans have only 3 months of income saved. So if they were to lose their jobs, within 3 months they would be broke. So that doesn't exactly represent a healthy society. Our middle class is becoming smaller and smaller.
Well, one of the things I found really interesting in your article was talking about wealth. And you equate wealth not with money, but with energy. So how do you draw that distinction? Why is money not wealth? Why is energy wealth?
Well, if you get back to the example I said earlier about how much work is in a barrel of oil and similar amounts are in the same size of coal or natural gas, historically human societies developed surplus, usually, you know, 10,000 years ago, in the form of grain and things like that, and they did human work combined with the ecosystem flows of sun and water and soil, and they produced things. You need work and energy and resources and non-renewable things like copper, et cetera, to create industry and capital. Well, most of our work, 90% of our work on this planet, is not done by humans. It's done by our fossil coworkers. And so energy really is the ultimate currency, and the reason this hasn't been noticed in the economics departments is because pretty much for the last 50 or 60 years, we had an increasingly wide spigot of access to energy. And we still have plenty of energy, but it's becoming harder and more costly to extract. So I would say the wealthiest places in the world in the next 50 years and the next 200 years are going to be those that have access to energy. And once fossil fuels gradually deplete and become too costly to pull out of the ground, it's going to be hydropower and things like that that allow us to do more work than a bunch of humans could do. So energy is our real wealth. Money is just a claim on who has the energy for now. And it's not just energy, of course. Our real wealth also is our natural capital of the planet, which includes energy, but also has minerals and water and forests and things like that. And then, you know, there's other intangible parts of wealth as well. There's, in the ecological economics view, in addition to natural capital, there's social capital, which is our relationships and the connections that we have. There's human capital, which is our health and our knowledge. And then there's built capital, which is, you know, the buildings and the tractors and the microscopes and the avocado peelers or whatever we have that we've already taken prior energy and resources and created into real stuff. So money is just a marker for all this stuff, and I would argue that it's increasingly disconnected with the things that underpin it.
Well, you actually gave a very interesting example of how banks actually create money and having to do with credit and debt. Let's talk a bit about that and how that is another indicator that money is not really has not that much to do with the actual wealth that we have in this planet.
Well, for a long time it did have a lot to do with it. It's just gotten disconnected recently. So a bank, and this is again counter to what our economics textbooks state. Economic textbooks say that banks are intermediaries. They take existing wealth and then distribute it via some fractional reserve multiplier. The truth is that when you go into your bank in Portland and ask for a loan, they'll check. You're kind of a famous radio personality. You've got good credit. So they'll give you $1 million loan for your new business. And the same moment that that $1 million shows up in your checking account, a $1 million IOU shows up in the bank's asset account. So the books are balanced from the perspective of the bank. But from the perspective of the economy, from the perspective of the world, from the perspective of our natural resource and energy balance sheet, all of a sudden there's a new $1 million of claims on future growth and stuff and energy and tin and copper and water that wasn't there 30 seconds ago. So this is okay. This is an empty planet rule that worked as an empty planet. The way this started happening in the U.S. was around 100 years ago when the Federal Reserve was created. And back then, and for a long time after, we needed more money in the economy. We had bright ideas and ambitious people and open land and lots of growing energy reserves to extract. And so we actually had a shortage of money. But at some point, and I, you know, we could argue about when that point was or is or will be, you end up getting too much money and too much credit relative to the natural world with energy and natural resources' ability to service it and pay it back. And I personally think that time was in the 1970s, and since then, at least this country and most countries in the world have grown their debt more than they've grown their economic output every single year. And so we're just papering over some of these difficulties in higher cost resources and more poverty and things like that with more guarantees, more credit, and it just makes the ultimate problem a little bit larger.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Nate Higgins, who's author of an article called Energy Credit and the End of Growth, which is included in World Watch Institute's State of the World 2015 anthology. And we're talking today about the contradiction between endless growth and the finite resources that we actually have on the planet, which gets me to my big question always, which is, how can we live under a system such as capitalism, which is dependent upon perpetual growth, when we have a finite planet and perhaps even a finite universe to draw from?
You know, when people talk, especially when they talk publicly, they inherently want to say things that people like to hear, of course. One of the things that it seems today is almost one of our prerequisites for a popular conversation is the rich are too greedy and we need to have wealth redistribution and there's so many poor people. And that's not just today. That's been for a very long time, probably since there were humans, we had such discussions. The problem with that is that you have to draw the boundaries of equality and fairness. Is it all Americans? Is it all people alive today? Does wealth equality include other generations of humans that will come after us and there's no fossil co-workers to help them? Does it include other species? Today, Pew Research came out that showed that 80% of humans on the planet today live under American poverty standards. So you ask a really thorny question on how we can live in a democracy when the engines of growth are starting to stall. And I don't really have good answers to it other than I predict, you know, not with 100% certainty, but with high confidence that we're going to have wider and deeper poverty both in this country and all around the world in the coming decades. And you know, there's national policy responses to that, and there's also individual responses to that. And my individual response is kind of collapse first and get ahead of the rush on that, in the sense that don't expect to always earn more and have more, and don't define what you measure your own personal success and aspirations by stuff and digits in the bank, because that's going to be a harder and harder ladder to climb.
Well, I want to sort of step aside for a moment, sort of try to tie in the conversation we're having about credit and debt with what's going on right now in Europe, because people, a lot of people are hearing, of course, about Greece being in this crisis with its debt and almost being bounced out of the Eurozone. I just wanted to get your take on that and how that reflects with some of these larger problems that you're looking at.
I think Greece is a perfect microcosm for what most industrialized nations face in the next decade or so. because they lived beyond their means. They are different than the United States, of course, because we have we produce around 80 to 85% of our own energy internally, not oil so much as coal and gas. Greece doesn't have that option. They don't. They also don't have the option to print their own money. But what's happening is you think about the analogy of the rich people in America versus the poor people. Well, that's kind of Greece versus Germany. And what they're trying to deal with is they don't have enough money not to pay their debt, but to just to pay the interest service on the debt right now. So they're trying to renegotiate and make the terms a little easier. And the creditors, the rich nations, don't want to let them off the hook, because that means they have to take write-offs themselves. So it's really a giant experiment of human behavior. And we've been having debt write-offs and jubilees since the time of the Bible, if not before. And so this is really kind of a musical chairs sort of situation. We don't have someone's going to have to take a haircut eventually, and we keep kicking the can because we don't want to really face what's happening. So they're doing everything they can to kick it a little bit further, and then that makes the larger problem down the road.
Well, actually, right now I'm reading this book about the rise of the Nazis in Germany, a book called In the Garden of Beasts, and there is a lot of talk about the massive debt that Germany owed after World War One, which they never paid off, and
right.
and that Roosevelt was torn between trying to service that debt and also not trying to help the rise of Hitler. And I think about what the outcome of that was and the pressure on Germany to pay its debt and what it did. Well, they just decided to take over the world instead. I don't think Greece is in that position, but I think it does show like what kinds of scary emotional responses nations have to being so much pressurized by debt. And particularly, it was the same was true with Nazi Germany as it is with Greece, that the interest on the debt was so burdensome that it wasn't even, there was no way it was possible to pay it off.
Well, yeah, I think Germany's all of a sudden this weekend started to look really bad because there were some comments that the finance minister actually wanted Greece to bail out of the Eurozone and print their own currency and go into economic chaos, because that would serve as an example to the next tier of countries that might have fiscal problems in Europe, like France and Italy. Like, you don't want to go there. Look at what happened to Greece. So I don't know. I mean, the euro is increasingly looking like a fixed rate exchange mechanism, and there were problems with that.
But what does that mean for those of us who aren't economists?
Well, it just means that the there's a one country with a large surplus, and that surplus is dictating the exchange rate for the weaker countries, and it there's a lot less fiscal flexibility for the weaker countries. They just have to continue to follow the rules of the leader. Here's kind of maybe this will explain debt in an easier way, because I've had this conversation like 10 times with my dad, and this finally allowed him to understand it. He's a doctor, not an economist, which is good for him, by the way. So debt you could view with two lenses. One lens is, yes, it is a zero-sum game. If you borrow $1 million and you're in debt, you owe $1 million, they're a creditor. So if you add up all those around the world, it truly is a zero sum. There's trillions of dollars of debt and trillions of dollars of credit, and it all nets out. So in that sense, the problem is a wealth inequality one, because over time, the people who had the money and had the means of production made it productive, made money, bought stocks, bought companies, and then very few people hold all of the credit. And there's a lot of poor people and some people in between. So in that sense, it's a zero-sum game. But from another lens, from a biophysical lens that looks at the natural world, every time new credit and debt are initiated and the whole zero-sum gets bigger, that's all in relation to natural resources and particularly energy. So in that sense, it's kind of a Ponzi scheme, in the sense that as we're creating more interest, principal, credit monetarily around the world, our energy and primary energy and natural resources are getting, the low-hanging fruit is gone. Now we have to drill under the ocean or up at the Arctic, and we have to use complicated fracking, which requires 100 trucks of sand for each well, et cetera. We're having higher costs. Our real cost of capital is not the interest rate at the bank. The real cost of capital is our cost of energy. And I think very few people in policy and international decision-making understand that.
Well, one of the interesting things that I've heard, the headlines blaring this morning about Greece, was that this deal that Greece has struck with the European Union basically deprives them of their sovereignty. And I'm wondering if you see that that's actually the case and what that means and how that could be equated back to what's going on here in the United States and around the rest of the world.
Well, imagine if Illinois were to go bankrupt. Would we kick them out of the dollar zone? What would happen? I mean, I think it's a really profoundly interesting question. I mean, what you just referred to is, in order for them to get the $80 billion of new aid, they had to basically sell a lot of their airports and islands and banks and allow the European institutions back into Greece to implement these reforms, and it does take away a little of the sovereignty, because you know the Don Corleone comes into town and says, this is how your country's going to be managed until we get paid back. So that, you know, that's a little bit of a problem. And how would that unfold in the United States? I have no idea. We're obviously much richer than Greece, but we're probably much more entitled as well. Someone has a $60,000 or $80,000 or $100,000 a year pension, and someone says that's going to be cut in half. Imagine what the average person in California or Oregon would do if they heard that.
Well, there's actually, we sort of had that around the PERS when there was, the PERS were going to be cut, and there was a huge uprising. And actually, this Oregon Supreme Court overturn the state legislature's cutting of the PERS benefits. So I think we've already seen what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that, but you know, basically, I think there are too many claims in existence for what can be paid back in the future, based on our main drivers of our economy, which is cheap fossil magic, basically, and so that's going to be an issue. Now, it's not a fully disaster, of course. I think for a lot of Americans, if they cut their consumption back 20% or 30% or 40%, they would be happier and healthier, but only as long as everyone else around them cuts back as well. I think we really don't face an energy shortage. I like to say we face a longage of expectations. People's expectations of their future consumption are out of line with reality.
Well, I want to get more into that, because I that's the last line in your article, and I kept reading it over and over, besides the fact that you made up a word, you know, that it really spoke a lot. I want to talk about how we change our basic assumptions, because what we started out talking about, the American dream, it may not, for those of us who went through a hippie period back in the 60s and 70s, we debunked the American dream back then, though I see a number of my peers who fell right back into it in the 80s. So how do we change our mindset so that we don't think we need so much, that we don't need these McMansions and all the iPhones and all the iDevices and all the luxurious travel and all these other things that a lot of people think are necessary to define themselves and to define their role and their status in the world?
Again, that's a very hard question. I could give you advice personally on how to do that, but how to answer that question for 320 million people or 7.3 billion people is difficult. I think we have to look at the way that the brain has built-in structures and responses in our evolved modular mind. And I think we very much care about relative performance and relative perception as opposed to absolute. In other words, economists have studied Would you prefer to live in a 4,000 square foot McMansion when all of your neighbors are 6,000 square foot? Or would you prefer to live in a smaller house, a 3,000 square foot house, when all of your neighbors are 2,000 square foot house? Most people would prefer to live in a smaller house as long as it was still bigger than their neighbors. So I think ultimately this comes down to redefining, in my case, redefining who I'm surrounding myself with every day. Instead of Wall Street guys high-fiving each other, making 20 grand commissions, I live rurally with farmers and teachers, and you know, there's a lot of poverty around here, so I don't feel as poor that I don't make a lot of money. And I also redefine, you know, what motivates me. I like to educate people. I like to help people. I like to learn things. I like to spending time in nature and with my dogs. And I try and remove myself from the social, immediate social necessities of comparing myself to people that have big houses and compete for large incomes and things like that. So I think it's really, you know, since you and I have lived on this planet, we were born into a culture that consumed, and we measured ourselves by the experiences we got from buying something, even though 2 weeks after we bought it, we felt a new craving to buy something else. And I think for most of our evolutionary history as humans, we pretty much knew that our wealth came from the sun and the soil and work. And we had kind of a natural cultural tether to our biophysical world. And since fossil fuels were so cheap, and we had 500 or 600 energy coworkers standing invisible behind us, we took all these things for granted. And so I think it's going to be a generation that figures this stuff out. Now, young people already today are figuring this out. They don't know all the details, but they know that, you know, they're coming out of college with these large debts, and there aren't as many jobs, and there aren't as many high-paying jobs. And since 2008, we've lost almost 2 million manufacturing jobs in this country, and we've gained exactly the same amount of waitress and bartender jobs. So, you know, it's not as easy to do things like when 20, 30 years ago. And I think young people are naturally gravitating towards smaller houses or no houses, or no cars, because it's starting to be cool, because it's starting to be necessary.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Nate Higgins, who's author of Energy Credit and the End of Growth, which appears in the State of the World 2015, Confronting Hidden Threats to Sustainability. Well, as you're talking about what young people are going through today, I'm remembering, actually, I mean, I graduated from college in 1971, which people will forget because it was in the middle of, you know, this great economic prosperity, but actually on the cover of Time magazine the week I graduated from college, it said, class of 1971, no job prospects. But the difference between then and now was I could move to Portland, Oregon, where it was really cheap to live, and just basically live the way I wanted, because I really didn't want to have that kind of job that would have made me a lot of money. So there were, I think that back 40, 50 years ago, almost 50 years ago now, there was this sort of tendency among certain young people to pull away from the quote American dream and not to buy into the whole Wall Street myth. And I don't think it came out of prosperity, though there was this job shortage definitely when I graduated. How would you compare what was going on then in terms of the impact it had on society and the causes for it with what's happening now with young people and the gargantuan debt? That's the difference between my graduating from college. I graduated from college debt-free. It's really different to graduate from college with $80,000 or $100,000 worth of debt.
Yeah, it's a very complicated question. There's a lot of major peaks in our country that happened in the first few years of the 1970s. Our oil production peaked in 1970. We went off the gold standard in 1971. Real wages peaked in 1973. There are alternative measures of GDP, something that I know Oregon is looking at called the Genuine Progress Indicator, which subtracts out the bad things. And the Genuine Progress Indicator for our country also peaked in the 1970s. So I think what happened is we had the beginnings of a cultural awakening. But then what happened is we went to globalization in order to find cheaper and cheaper costs of production overseas, and we went to debt, not only the United States, but most, well, all nations in the world. And so that kind of kicked the can 30 to 40 years forward on, and also a giant, great acceleration on, you know, what could easily be defined as the ecological equivalent of genocide on the natural world with what we're doing to other species and ecosystems. Just the whole size of the human heat engine has just exploded since 1971. So, yeah, it's a big question.
Well, I also see that the upside of the slowdown of the economic engine and our needing to get off of fossil fuels because they just aren't really affordable anymore is that it could be an upside for the environment, what's left of it, and the possibility to start to restore all the damage that we've done. And I'm wondering if you think that there's a real shift in consciousness there, that we are starting to really value the environment enough to really rethink some of the things that we've done to it in the name of progress.
Well, without naming names, someone close to me, a woman who's about your age, very Republican, talked to her about climate change. She thinks it's a socialist scam. I've talked to her about oil depletion, and her guess was that we had 1 million years left of oil. And I talked to her about the fact that humans and our livestock outweigh wild animals, wild terrestrial vertebrates, 60-1. And that stopped her in her tracks, and she said, we're taking more than our share. And that really impacted her. So I think that the fact that we are squeezing out the natural world is something that conservatives and liberals can agree is not a good thing. And I think that's where the change in consciousness could surprisingly happen.
Well, I'm wondering what caused your change in consciousness, because you worked for some pretty heavy lifting financial institutions up until how long ago?
Well, I was always kind of curious about how things fit together in the natural world. In 1999, I started reading books because I was trading oil futures then for my organization, and I started reading books that oil would peak and decline in my lifetime, and I looked at how powerful it is, and then I started reading books on ecology, which really explain the truth of our natural system. Finance and economics really kind of explains what's happened recently and makes up explanations for it. And then I decided, wow, this is what I'm really passionate about, and I started reading a lot of books to the point where I was slacking at managing my clients' money and stuff, and eventually I just shut down my hedge fund, gave my clients their money back, and I traveled 6 months at a time with my dog with a backpack full of books by Herman Daly and Daniel Quinn, and you know, I just felt like we're at the end of an era and we need some new narratives and new explanations about humans living on a full planet as opposed to an empty planet, and so that was 15 years ago or so.
Now, when you talk about an empty planet, what, as I don't know, I think of the planet as being empty for a really, really long period of time, but what do you mean by empty planet versus full planet?
Well, the planet's always been full of things, but right now it's an ecologically full planet of humans. The human enterprise, I mean, we take 35 or so percent of the net primary productivity of the sun hitting the earth every day, not to mention all the other impacts. So the human organism, 10,000 years BC, we were about 1 million humans. So we're 7,300 times that large now. And so the rules that humans engaged in on an empty planet, they didn't really have to care about the larger impacts, because no matter what we did, we couldn't really mess things up that badly. But now there are different rules, both on the energy source side, like how we can get the stuff that we need, and on the sink side, which is our waste streams in the ocean and the biosphere, and in squeezing out other species, living space. So I like to explain it as we are now on an ecologically full planet of humans, and all signs are that it's going to get fuller before it's resolved.
So what is your thought? I mean, we talked a little bit about what people can do on an individual level. One of the things you seem to stress in your article is that we probably are going to be able to rely less on governments to fill basic needs and to basically provide the leveling forces and the safety net and everything that we expect in a liberal democracy to provide. So what do you see as the alternative to the kind of social contract with the government that we, let's say the post-Roosevelt social contract that we, I guess many of us believe, except for far-right Tea Party people, is, you know, the core, the basis of American democracy?
Another complicated question. I think we are going to still rely on government, and we're going to have to, but the government is going to have less and less resources. And so eventually there's going to be a sort of triage where there's five things that people want, and we're only going to be able to pay four of them, and then eventually three of them, and then eventually two of them. And the sooner that we can get individuals and communities and cities and maybe states or regions to get ahead of that curve on rejiggering their consumption profiles, rejiggering their supply chains, rejiggering their aspirations, the more resilient we'll be as a whole, in my opinion. As far as the social contract with the government, I have no insight into how that might alter or change, other than to say we are headed for a world where we all expect slightly more or quite a bit more next year, and we're going to be headed for slightly less or the same or quite a bit less in the coming decades. And that, you know, that's not something we're used to.
Though actually, I can think of some models in the past that I think people could look back on, for instance, the Victory Gardens during World War One and World War Two, where people grew their own food, basically, in the cities as well as in the countryside. And I think about a lot of the basically private community organizations that turned into nonprofits later on, but I think that they probably were a lot of those earlier on, probably during the 30s and certainly during the 60s and 70s, whether there were free clinics or food co-ops that grew up or all kinds of community-based groups that served the community and did it for not profit. And I wonder if you see that as another model that we might be looking, we can look back to and maybe look forward to recreating.
I do think that is another model, but what's first required is a recognition not among the fringe, but among, you know, 10 or 15% of a community that this is in fact coming and that the community needs to get together and create these models. I also think another successful model back from that era was the Civilian Conservation Corps that kind of created, not jobs, but created work on environmental initiatives that needed to be done. And that created incomes for people. And I do think that when tough times arrive, 95% of people just kind of overnight adapt to the new situation, help each other out. I think that will happen again. I would strongly urge people that live in your state, which has a low population, kind of already is ahead of the curve in progressive thinking, to really get ahead of this and establish initiatives and start talking about what happens if growth stalls or declines. And it's such a threatening topic that usually we just kind of defer it because it's too painful to consider. But I think Oregon has options that California and New York might not. I grew up in Oregon, by the way, in Ashland.
Oh, cool. Well, actually, there's a lot of people talking about that stuff here, and you hear a lot about it on this radio station. So,
we'll
keep up the work. So anyway, it's been really great to talk with you, Nate. Thanks a whole lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been talking this morning with Nate Hagans, author of Energy Credit and the End of Growth, which appears in State of the World 2015, Confronting Hidden Threats to Sustainability. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll get an update on LNG terminals and other petrochemical threats to the Pacific Northwest from Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Tom Waits. Thanks for listening.
Everyone's a winner, bargains galore. That's right, you too can be the proud owner. The quality goes in before that name goes on. One-tenth of a dollar, one-tenth of a dollar. We got service after the sale. How about perfume? We got perfume. How about an engagement ring? Some for the little lady, some for the little lady, some for the little lady. $3-$4. We got a year-end clearance. We got our white sale and a smoke-damaged furniture. You can drive it away today. Act now, and receive as our gift to you. They come in all colors, one size fits all. No muss, no fuss, no spills. You're tired of kitchen drudgery. Everything must go. Going out of business, going out of business, going out of business sale. 50% off original retail price. Skip the middle man.
Yeah. You have it tuned to KBOO Portland. It is just a few seconds before 11 a.m. And coming up is Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. Today he interviews Kat Ellis, author of Prepper's Natural Medicine, about safely creating home medicines when a major disaster has rendered doctors, hospitals, and pharmacies unavailable. And you'll want to stay tuned at 11:30. We're going to hear Food Sleuth Radio with guest Amy Mondlock, community organizer with the Toxic Taters Coalition campaign, discussing pesticide drift and how it is harming people, animals, and the environment. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
Attention, KBOO members. You are invited to give your feedback on KBOO's draft mission and vision statements. Based on member feedback from the recent survey and member retreat, KBOO